Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we still have Paul Venable. And he's been actually, Paul, this has been a good solid run in doing the ratification debates. And I can't tell you how much I really appreciate your help. This is the end of it, though. So,
well, I can't tell you how enlightening this has been, especially with North Carolina. These are gems of knowledge that we really should be using.
Yeah, absolutely. All of them are. As a matter of fact, all of them have their. This is why I kind of point out that, you know, you could really gain a lot out of Virginia. And I think you can really gain a lot out of North Carolina. These two are really important, but there's still some uniquenesses. Like Massachusetts happened to be the only one ratification debate that pointed out that the public servants would not have the authority to pass a law and immune themselves from it.
Okay.
They're the only ones that pointed that out. And so when you really look at the contract, it doesn't matter if it's one party that stipulated it or if it's all the parties. If one party does, if it is stipulated by one, it is stipulated by all. It is applicable throughout. And the reason that is because the federal government can't treat one party differently. In other words, they can't behave differently for these guys than these other guys. They have to behave uniformly. They have to treat the states equally. They have to behave, you know, and interact with them with the same, you know, courtesies, the same, you know, formalities, the same processes and so forth. If not, then it becomes this, you know, okay, well, we treat Texas differently and we treat California differently and we treat Hawaii differently. And they start creating all these different cases that every, you know, every parent gets a little different kind of love from the child.
And a child certainly takes advantage
of it. Oh, absolutely. And a child learns quickly how to do that.
Right.
And so this is why the lesson learned, if it is stipulated by one, it is stipulated by all. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so we still have a lot to go through. I mean, we're almost one third through the ratification debates, but this is where it really starts heating up. This is where they really start going through and insisting the Bill of Rights and talking about some of the problems. This is the first point where we really get into, and as a matter of fact, it was Mr. Whitman Hill that's the one that makes this comment. And so this is where they inject and make comment to paper money. And it's, in a way, it's almost like he's defending the honor of North Carolina because he starts justifying, we had no other choice. We had to do that. And because the rest of the union is kind of, you know, saying, hey, you know, Rogue Island and North Carolina and, you know, these few states that created this paper species gave us worthless money. Mm-hmm. And so they knew that their integrity, their honor was impugned, and they're trying to justify this. And this is what we're seeing. But the reason this is important, folks, is because this Constitution invoked and demanded a secure currency where the people could not be robbed of their wealth, and our paper fiat currency is literally robbing us of our wealth.
So before we get into that, let me ask you a question real quick. I think you and I had a conversation that wasn't over the radio, and we were talking about paper money, and you know there is, and then when the CDBC came up, you know, many of us, you know, went to our states and said, you know, if paper money is bad, then the digital currency is worse. But here's something that came up in our conversation. It went something like this. It may be okay. one of the pictures people have is traveling around with gold and silver coins in their pockets. And what we had at one time is we had paper that represented gold and silver. Right.
They were gold and silver certificates.
So that is, so I want to make sure I understand that is not the same thing as paper money.
That is correct.
Those gold and silver certificates are redeemable in gold and silver.
Right.
And that is how you still make nothing but gold and silver a currency, right? I don't remember the exact term, nothing, but you can use paper as convenience to represent it.
Right. So if you really looked at the different denominations of silver, and I think the common ones, and actually let me go to, because this is a good segue. It's really good to probably dive into this. I'm just going to go to Monex, and I'm going to look up silver products that they sell. Because bottom line, when you have a certificate, you have these different denominations, right?
Right.
Okay. So when we look at the different types of denominations under silver, you know, they have a 10-ounce. So you have a 1-ounce silver coin, which is $1. The next denomination of silver that they make out there is a 10-ounce. So in other words, there wouldn't be a $5, you know, or a 5-ounce bar. It's a little 10-ounce bar of silver.
All right.
The next denomination would be 100, and the 100 is 100 ounces of silver. A $100 bill or $100 certificate, silver certificate, is, you know, 100 ounces of a silver certificate equates to 100 ounces of silver. The next denomination is 1,000 ounces, and then the next denomination is 1 kilo.
Okay.
So in other words, there should be a $1,000 bill or a $1,000 ounce of silver, right? Of 1,000 ounce silver certificate, and then a kilo silver certificate.
Okay.
And a kilo is what, 2.2 pounds. Which is, you know, if you do the math on that, you know, it'll tell you how many. It's like 2,000-something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Actually, no, it's 3,000-and-something because, right, 16 ounces make a pound?
No, so real quick, let me ask you something else I've heard. And I want to make sure, because I tried to get someone to answer this to me. What is the difference between 16 ounces or a pound and a troy ounce? Because I believe it's different in that, for example, a pound of gold does not weigh the same as a pound of feathers. Does that make sense? Now, there's this thing called a troy ounce, and I think it is different from an ounce.
So, let me just look it up since you're actually bringing it up. A troy ounce versus an ounce. Let me see here. The importance of troy ounces as they kind of break it down. Troy ounce versus an ounce. And I think it might be, you know, the measuring, possibly. Precious metals and gold, silvers are excellent investments. What is a troy ounce? A troy ounce is in advertisements, marketing materials for precious metals like gold and silver. Typically, individuals familiarize the troy ounce as a thorough understanding of its role in understanding the value of metals. A troy ounce is a unit of weight used to measure the mass precious metals since medieval times and so forth. The abbreviation of a troy ounce is an ounce with a T dot. And so I don't know what that is, but I think it is comes down to this. A troy ounce is something like 28.3445 grams, or 1/16 of a pound, or 437.5 grains. And so I don't know if an ounce is necessarily rounded out, but every ounce that you buy, if you buy a 1 ounce silver dollar, I believe they are troy ounces. They just use troy as a, and I could be wrong, but to me, it's just a denotation that this is a very, very precise measurement of 1/16th of an ounce, which comes out to a very specific measurement of grains and or, as they say, 28.3495 grams.
Yeah, and what I found, which is a little simpler explanation, is 1 troy ounce is equal to 1.097 standard ounces, which makes it around 10% heavier. So I just wanted to make sure that I distinguished between, you know, what do we use in ounces and what is a troy ounce. So thanks for looking that up, you know, indulging me with that question.
Yeah.
Because I think that may be important to know.
Right, because I truly believe that when you're looking at buying an ounce of silver, it's not like an ounce of parsley or, you know, pepper or that type of thing. When they do an ounce of silver for a coin, like a Liberty coin, it's a troy ounce. I believe that they use troy ounces.
Right.
Okay. They don't denote that, you know, and because it's just, maybe we've just gotten lazy to where we don't differentiate. That's all. I think that's what it is. Because, you know, LOL means something better than LOL.
Right. Okay.
Right. We're getting lazy. That's the indictment, I think, that we can lay out here. So anyway, right. Let's go ahead and pick up with Mr. Hill here.
Yeah, this is going to take a while. This is several paragraphs, so here we go.
Okay.
I conceive, sir, that the power given by the clause is absolutely necessary to the existence of a government. Gentlemen say that we are in such a situation that we cannot pay taxes. This, sir, is not a fair representation, in my opinion. The honest people of this country acknowledge themselves sufficiently able and willing to pay them. Were it a private contract, they would find means to pay them. The honest part of the community complain of the acts of the legislature. They complain that the legislature makes laws not to suit their constituents, but themselves. The legislature, sir, never means to pay a just debt, as their constituents wish to do. Witness the laws made in this country. I will, however, be bold enough to say that it is the wish of the honest people to pay those taxes which are necessary for the support of the government. We have for a long time waited in hope that our legislature would point out the manner of supporting the general government and relieving us from our present ineligible situation. Everybody was conceived of the necessity of this, but how is it to be done? The legislature have pointed out a mode, their old favorite mode. They have made paper money, purchased tobacco at an extravagant price, and sold it at a considerable loss. They have received about a dollar in the pound. Have we any ground to hope that we shall be in a better situation? So, real quick, Mr. Whitman Hill, is he arguing for or against paper money?
He's arguing for it, but he's also defending the fact of what they had to do because of their current situation. Now, we already read in some of the other states that, and I think it was South Carolina that pointed this out, and there was another state that kind of said very similar, that if somebody had gold, they didn't give it up. They wouldn't use it. They would barter with other things because they would hold on to their gold because they knew that they're not going to get paid in gold for anything that they do. There was such a shortage of gold in the country that when people put gold in their pockets, they would then barter with other commodities because that's all that they had. Their currency, the cash crop, their cash was tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a lot of tobacco that was worth a certain amount of money. You take it down and exchange that. And technically, the general stores were the exchange points.
Right.
They were the ones that actually kept the books to say, okay, I received this lug or whatever of tobacco. And so therefore, you know, you're given credit to get, you know, this amount of goods from me and, you know, of this value. And they're basically supposed to be fixing their prices so that, you know, you got your full value out of that. Now, they didn't have enough gold. They didn't have enough of that species here. And so the Constitution mandated that that only the specie would be created, only the specie would be done. And that's why if you look at the first Treasury Act of 1792, that anybody could actually bring in gold and silver to the mint, and they would be given whatever that value was in coin. So in other words, if you brought in, you know, 5 ounces of gold or 5 ounces of silver, you would be given, you know, 5 1-ounce coins. So sure. That you could now use that instead of this, you know, these little the powdered gold or nuggets of gold or what have you.
Right.
And go ahead.
The other thing that's interesting is there's nothing that prohibited the people from freely trading other commodities for value. So there's nothing that prohibited these farmers from taking tobacco and exchanging it for something else.
Right. Because and that basically is what they said here. He basically said that, you know, the people did what they could in their private contracts. That's what it says right here. Were it a private contract, they would find means to pay them. This was what honest people were doing. And so most of the people were honest in trying to pay their private contracts or just trying to pay their debt and being able to buy things and so forth. And so it truly was a bartering system. Everything was a commodity.
Right.
But the basis of value of our currency and everything else slowly gained this footing of gold and silver. And then, as a matter of fact, they introduced copper as well for the penny.
Mm.
And then later on, they introduced the nickel, right?
Right. In the nickel metal, right?
And right, the nickel metal. Right. That was before they even invented or discovered, you know, platinum and palladium.
Okay.
All right.
Sure. All right.
I don't think anybody wants to carry plutonium. But...
No. Okay. So next paragraph.
Sure.
Shall we be bettered by the alternative proposed by gentlemen by levying taxes in specific articles? How will you dispose of them? Where is the merchant to buy them? Your business will be put into the hands of a commissioner who, having no business of his own, will grasp at it eagerly, and he, no doubt, will manage it. But if the shipment of the tax be left to the people, if individuals are told they must pay such a certain proportion of their income to support the general government, then each will consider it as a debt. He will exert his ingenuity and industry to raise it. He will use no agent but depend on himself. By these means, the money will certainly be collected. I will pledge myself for its certainty. As the legislature has never heretofore called upon the people, let the general government apply to individuals. Huh? It cannot depend upon states. If the people have articles, they can receive money for them. Money is said to be scarce, but sir, it is the want of industry which is the source of our indigence and difficulties. If people would be but active and exert every power, they might certainly pay and be in easy circumstance, and the people are disposed to do so. I mean the good part of the community, which I trust is the greater part of it. In this paragraph, he seems to be saying, he seems to be defending the need for money.
Yes.
For paper.
No. He's not applying paper. He's just talking about the necessity of. So he's even pointing out here because he says money is said to be scarce. But, sir, it is the want of industry which is the source of our indigence and difficulties. In other words, if the people would be but active and exert every power, they might certainly pay and be in easy circumstance. So you're looking at a slave state, and many of the people didn't have plantations.
Okay.
Many of the people, if they even had slaves, they could barely, you know, rub two dimes together. So they didn't have the money. And this is the one thing that Thomas Sowell pointed out, that slavery made the South lazy.
Right.
They didn't have industry. The people weren't willing to work.
Right. And it's I've got to find it, but just in the last week, it was I read this article about this guy who did an experiment with mice, and he made food readily available to these mice, and he's done this experiment over and over and over again. And because they didn't have to work for it or search for it, every one of these experiments failed because the mice were lazy. And in maybe three or four generations, and the mice have short generations, they were all dead. And so I brought that up because it's the value of work has been on my mind for some time. And uh-huh. This seems to indicate that if there is an industry and if people aren't working, they're not, you know, they're not benefiting. I may wind up segueing into something else because it is the bane of welfare. That's what it does. People get comfortable not working.
Right.
And it doesn't benefit them.
Okay. So
in fact, slaves them. If I'm going off on a tangent.
No. So what I'm doing is I'm actually, because Thomas Sowell talks and documents about how, and I'm trying to figure out what this river is between the Ohio and the West Virginia. What river is that? The Ohio River. Yeah. Okay, so it is the Ohio River. And so in Black Rednecks, White Liberals, is in his book, he talks about how historians made stark observations that when you traveled down, because to the north of the river was the Pennsylvania state, which was basically expanding into Ohio. Remember, Ohio didn't exist. It was a territory and was considered a part of Pennsylvania. And okay. So And this was a very obvious trip. As you actually traveled along the Ohio River, on the south side, the properties, you would see, the cows just starving. The fields were not developed where they were, you know, able to grow grass. They were forests and so forth because they didn't take the time to clear the forest or the woods so that you could actually, you know, have grass for your cows to feed. So you'd actually see these starving indigent cows, you know, and the lack of butter. He even pointed to how the majority of the butter was coming from the north, even though there were more cows in the south. Why? Because they were able to be more productive because they actually did what was they were industrious enough to do what was necessary to produce more butter.
Wow.
And so he was making this really stark contrast, and this is what we're seeing, what he was just talking about. He's basically testifying how you can see the, and unless you actually take this type of empirical data that Thomas Sowell had done. And this, I mean, because when you read this part of the North Carolina debate, you'd skim over that and you would not even really think about how lazy the people have gotten already in America, that they lacked industry. We've got 2 seconds, 1 second. We've ran out of time. My apologies. We're going into break. So folks, we will be right back after this short promo. So please stay tuned because obviously this is really good stuff. There's a lot of meat in these things and it gives us a lot of insights regarding our history and so forth and why we have all of these problems. And there's more information there that we're gleaming and that's what we're trying to bring out for you. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
You know, so when you really think about it, there's a lot of little things that really contribute to the industry of our society. And really, I'll just say it this way, folks, it's enlightenment. Enlightenment incorporates and embraces discipline, so that we actually do what's necessary to improve our productivity. You know, go clear those trees so that you can make that land as productive as possible. While you're clearing those trees, you sell that timber for lumber, or you use it to build your buildings that you need to, you know, store your cows and those types of things. You build your barns. And so when we're doing those things and we're being productive, we enjoy the fruits of our labor. When we start doing things to become slothful and lazy, like, you know, what was one of the biggest downfalls of productivity was stills and making liquor.
Really?
Absolutely. Because, I mean, how many people were alcoholics in those days? And, you know, so if you're consumed by always having to have your drink, then how productive are alcoholics? Mm-hmm. It's a very destructive, you know, I'll just say behavior. It's not productive for society, for people to be alcoholics. We should want to purge ourselves of that. We can't force people to do that. That's why self-discipline is so important. And teaching self-discipline instead of encouraging people, and so that you can show here is the you know, the fruits that you can enjoy by using, you know, it was brought up, you know, that and because in contrast to myself and, you know, my wife and I, we don't go on vacations. I mean, we go visit and spend time with family. That's not a vacation. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, serving the obligatories and staying engaged because we're a part of a family. And so it is really a moral obligation that we, you know, we do those things. But just to go spend money, hard-earned money, to do something without actually obtaining the fruit. Now, some people say, well, you get to, you know, enjoy the memories and those types of things. But if I'm spending Monday, whether I'm spending money or spending my time on Monday doing work endeavors, improving, and, if you know, working on innovations and those types of things, or whether I'm sitting on a beach, you know, paying somebody, giving them a tip for bringing me a drink or something, you know, I just can't see doing that. It's not productive. Right. Vacations. You know, yeah, the body needs rest. It needs variety even. But, you know, and so, you know, actually, I looked at our traveling for business, you know, when we did some of those types of things, you know, that was kind of our vacation. It was business, though. We were still working. And so, I don't know. I mean, I know people live for their vacations in America. That's one of the things that if you mess around with people's vacations, they really get upset. You know, you can trample on their liberties and they'll tolerate that, but you don't play with their vacation time.
Right.
Are you kidding me? In other words, your vacation is more precious of a liberty than your religious worship, your freedom of speech, and these other things. And this is how backwards we are. I'm just ranting a little bit so that I'm trying to place perspective here. The only reason America became great is because people decided to discipline themselves. And they decided to start moving away. It's not like, even though America may have been great in Alexis de Tocqueville's mind because they were going to church or what have you, but there was still enough slothfulness and there's still enough laziness to realize that, you know, America really, you know, had its problems. Right. And we were on this path of enlightenment, but to be clear, the South really had problems. There were educated people of the South, and these people we're talking, that are talking here, were very educated, but they were not the real representation. And this is why it's really, it's exposing. It is very revealing to see, you know, what these guys are talking about, because he really just put it out there. Mm-hmm. Our source of indigence is our lack of industry.
Right.
Right. Okay. So go on.
Let me pick up. I think
where the money to be paid.
That's what I asked.
Yep.
Were the money to be paid into our treasury first instead of recommitting it to the continental treasury, we should apply it to discharge our own pressing demands, by which means a very small proportion of it would be paid to Congress. And if the tax were to be laid and collected by the several states, what would be the consequence? Congress must depend upon 12 funds for its support. The general government must depend upon the contingency of succeeding. Did he say this twice or just the general government must depend on the contingency of succeeding in 12 different applications to 12 different bodies? What a slender and precarious dependence would this be? The states, when called upon to pay these demands of Congress, would fail. They would pay every other demand before those of Congress. They have hitherto done it. Is not this a true statement of facts? How is it with the Continental Treasury? The true answer to this question must hurt every friend to this country. I came in late, but I believe that a gentleman, Governor Johnston, said that if the states should refuse to pay requisitions and the Continental officers were sent to collect, the states would be degraded and the people discontented. I believe this would be the case. The states, by acting dishonestly, would appear in the most odious light, and the people would be irritated at such an application after a rejection by their own legislature. But if the taxes were to be raised of individuals, I believe they could, without any difficulty, be paid in due time. But sir, the United States wish to be established and known among other nations. This will be a matter of great utility to them. We might then form advantageous connections. When it is once known among foreign nations that our general government and our finances are upon a respectable footing, should emergencies happen, we can borrow money of them without any disadvantage. The lender would be sure of being reimbursed in time. This matter is of the highest consequence to the United States. Loans must be recurred to sometimes. In case of war, they would be necessary. All nations borrow money on pressing occasions. The gentleman who was last up mentioned many specific articles which could be paid by the people in discharge of their taxes. He has, I think, been fully answered. He must see the futility of such a mode. When our wants would be greatest, these articles would be least productive. I mean in time of war. But we still have means, such means as honest and assiduous men will find. He says that Congress cannot lay the tax to suit us. He has forgotten that Congress are acquainted with us, go from us, are situated like ourselves. I will be bold to say it will be most their own interest to behave with moderation. their own interest will prompt them to lay taxes moderately, and nothing but the last necessity will urge them to recur to that expedient. This is a most essential clause. Without money, government will answer no purpose. Gentlemen, compare this to a foreign tax. It is by no means the case. It is laid by ourselves. Our own representatives lay it, and will, no doubt, use the most easy means of raising it possible. Why not trust our own representatives? We might, no doubt, have confidence in them on this occasion, as well as every other. If the Continental Treasury is to depend on the states as usual, it will always be poor. But gentlemen are jealous and unwilling to trust government, though they are their own representatives. Their maxim is, trust them with no power. This holds against all government. Anarchy will ensue if government is not trusted. I think that I know the sentiments of the honest, industrious part of the community, as well as any gentleman in this house. They wish to discharge these debts and are able. If they can raise the interest of the public debt, it is sufficient. They will not be called upon for more than the interest till such time as a country may be rich and populous. The principal can then be paid with great facility.
So one of the things he's pointing out is as hard as it may seem for most people, one of the things he covered here was that even though we want to pay, you know, our own debt and so forth, and if we actually go down this path of putting the state before the nation in this particular case of taxation and paying our debt to the nation, it would make it hard for the nation to be able to obtain the credit that would actually open up overseas markets and allow us, you know, to flourish more as a nation, as a collective of states.
Okay.
And so he's pointing out that there is a symbiotic relation, a mutually benefiting relationship of taking care of the general government so it can do the good things for the union.
Right.
And those good things is really opening up our economy so that we can, you know, sell our wares and do what we need. You know, even though, you know, at this point we're in such a dire situation that, you know, we may have to actually, you know, withdraw ourselves from most all trade in the world. And I just say that because most all trade in the world is being done with or under the controls of communist China. We have no business doing business with them. We don't. And everything that we do that gives them, you know, a benefit is a detriment to us. Does that make sense?
That's absolutely, I agree with you completely.
Right. I mean, you know, if we give them a pile of lead, they turn that into bullets to use against us. That's right. Basically what's happening. And so everything that we give them, they use it to form or, you know, to leverage more weaponry against us.
Yep.
We are their enemy. We are their target. This is it. I mean, you can't put it any more plainly. So we have to really look at, and I believe that, you know, the world could have a real hard time without America. A real hard time. But I think America could do just fine on its own. Especially as we restore our manufacturing, especially as we restore our industries and so forth. But gone are the days for us to actually, you know, just fall back into a services state. I mean, because that's what America is. It's really more of a services nation than it is production, industry, and so forth. So anyway, so he, the last part that he covers is this concept of interposition and so forth and how to do that. And he mentions this at the very bottom here. So go ahead and read this last part.
Okay. We can't borrow money with ease and on advantageous terms when it shall be known that Congress will have that power which all governments ought to have. Oh, I'm sorry. We can borrow with money with ease and on advantageous terms when it shall be known that Congress will have that power which all governments ought to have. Congress will not pay their debts in paper money. I'm willing to trust this article to Congress because I have no reason to think that our government will be better than it has been. Perhaps I have spoken too liberally of the legislature before, but I do not expect that they will ever, without a radical change of men and measures, wish to put the general government on a better footing. What is he saying here? It sounds like he's saying that he doesn't trust that our representatives will do to our advantage.
So he's calling out the cabal of North Carolina.
Okay,
so remember, I told you that every single one of these debates was a vigorous debate. The reason they were vigorous is because there was an existing cabal.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they didn't just want to slam dunk this and say, yeah, this is a much better thing. And this is why, and he's literally pointing the finger at the legislature and saying, you know, these guys are the problems.
Okay. All right. Got it.
Okay.
Okay. Perhaps I've spoken too liberally of the legislature before, but I do not expect that they will ever, without a radical change of men and measures, wish to put the general government on a better footing. It is not the poor man who opposes the payment of those just debts to which we owe our independence and political existence, but the rich miser. Not the poor, but the rich shudder at the idea of taxes. I have no dread that Congress will distress us, nor have I any fear that the tax will be embezzled by officers. Industry and economy will be promoted, and money will be easier got than ever it has been yet. The taxes will be paid by the people when called upon. I trust that all honest industrial people will think with me that Congress ought to be possessed of the power of applying immediately to the people for its support. Without the interposition of the state legislatures, I have no confidence in the legislature. The people do not suppose them to be honest men. That is not complimentary, Jerry.
No, it's not. But he is pointing out that they do have the ability to constrain the federal government. But the problem is that they're just not trusting him at all.
Right.
And he's pointing out that they can be trusted. The people that can't are you.
Wow.
And some of them are in that room. Yes. You know, and okay. So obviously, you know, this is a very revealing debate. You know, where you got some of that in Virginia and, you know, actually we didn't get it in Pennsylvania, but and possibly in New York, but in North Carolina, they're pretty frank. They were pretty forthright in saying what they were thinking. And so anyway, so now we've got 10 minutes and now we've covered the interposition. Now, because they're still talking about paper money. Again, this really didn't land well with them that, you know, the whole union was speaking about, oh, what a relief it is that we're getting away from paper money.
Okay. All right. So this is
Governor Johnston.
Right?
Right. Okay. Who happens to be a Federalist. He happens to be in favor of this Constitution.
Okay. Something has been said with regard to their paper money. I think very little can be done in favor of it. Much may be said very justly in favor of it. Every man of property, every man of considerable transactions, whether a merchant, planter, mechanic, or of any other condition, must have felt the baneful influence of that currency. It gave us relief for a moment. It assisted us in the prosecution of a bloody war. It is destructive, however, in general, in the end. It was struck in the last instance for the purpose of paying the officers and soldiers. The motive is laudable. I then thought, and still do, that those gentlemen might have had more advantage by not receiving that kind of payment. It would have been better for them and for the country had it not been emitted. We have involved ourselves in debt over 200,000 pounds. We have not, with this sum, honestly and fairly paid 50,000 pounds. Was this right? But say they, there was no circulating medium.
There was no circulating medium, right. In other words, right. You know, gold or silver.
Right. Okay. This want was necessary to be supplied. It is a doubt with me whether the circulating medium be increased by an emission of paper currency. Before the emission of the paper money, there was a great deal of hard money among us. For 30 years past, I had not known so much specie in circulation as we had at the emission of paper money in 1783. The medium was increasing daily. People from abroad bring specie, for thank God our country produces articles which are everywhere in demand. There is more specie in the country than is generally imagined, but the proprietors keep it locked up. No man will part with his specie. It lies in his chest. It is asked, why not lend it out? The answer is obvious that should he once let it get out of his power, he never can recover the whole of it. If he brings suit, he will obtain a verdict for one half of it. This is the reason of our poverty. The scarcity of money must be in some degree owing to this, and that specie which is now in this country might as well be in any other part of the world. If our trade was once a respectable footing, we should find means of paying that enormous debt.
Right. So there you go. I mean, he basically restated what was being stated, I think, in Pennsylvania. I think it was the Pennsylvania debate where they talked about that. And so, So now we go into the next day, the second section of the second article, which is the, you know, President of the United States. And this is Mr. Iredell. And this is the delegated, where we actually get to it, you'll actually find the delegated militia. And militia comments, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I was in hopes that some other gentleman would have spoken to this clause. It conveys very important powers and ought not to be passed by. I beg leave in as few words as possible to speak my sentiments upon it. I believe most of the governors of the different states have powers similar to those of the president. In almost every country, the executive has the command of the military forces. From the nature of the thing, the command of armies ought to be delegated to one person only. The secrecy, dispatch, and decision which are necessary in military operations can only be expected from one person. The president, therefore, is to command the military forces of the United States, and this power, I think a proper one, at the same time, it will be found to be sufficiently guarded. A very material difference may be observed between this power and the authority of the King of Great Britain under similar circumstances. The King of Great Britain is not only the commander-in-chief of the land and naval forces, but has power in time of war to raise fleets and armies. He has also authority to declare war. The president has not the power of declaring war by his own authority, nor that of raising fleets and armies. These powers are vested in individuals. The power of declaring war is expressly given to Congress, that is, to the two branches of the legislature, the Senate, composed of the representatives of the state legislatures, the House of Representatives, deputed by the people at large. They have also expressly delegated to them the powers of raising and supporting armies and of providing and maintaining a navy. With regard to the militia, it must be observed that though he has the command of them when called into the actual service of the United States, yet he has not, and I think he's referring to the president, yet he has not the power of calling them out. The power of calling them out is vested in Congress for the purpose of executing the laws of the Union. When the militia are called out for any purpose, some person must command them, and who so proper as that person who is the best evidence of his possessing the general confidence of the people. I trust, therefore, that the power of commanding the militia when called forth into the actual service of the United States will not be objected to.
Okay, so in reading this, and in light of what Biden had done last week, it's very clear Biden has no authority to call up these reserve forces. He has actually no authority to deploy forces into a combat situation or what have you. Now, it's one thing if Congress recognized that the hostilities coming from Iran are, you know, unacceptable, then they need to be the ones to say and actually dictate that, you know, what they're doing is tantamount to war. And they need to declare war on those types of hostilities, and that we will engage them appropriately in empowering the president by allocating those forces. But only Congress can do that.
Correct. Well, here's the other thing, GR. Congress should know this and should be jealously guarding their authority, and they're not doing it.
Right. And as a matter of fact, the Republicans during the Obama administration went to the Supreme Court, and Obama got slapped down by violating the separations of power.
Okay. Well, so what happens is, how should I put this? Sometimes I don't know what's going on now, because sometimes Republicans act more like Republicans when you have a Democratic president. All right. They don't seem to be doing that this administration. Does that make sense? I mean, they seem to be cheering it on.
Well, so actually, if you remember, when Obama became president, Congress, the Republican Congress, when we finally got the Republican majority, all of a sudden, Congress just came out and said, well, we promise we won't impeach you.
What?
That's basically what Congress did. Congress told President Obama that, well, I mean, we don't like what you're doing, but we're not going to impeach you. In other words, that was empowering. That was enabling him.
Where was I? How did I miss that?
Oh, you didn't realize that there were definitely infractions and points where, I mean, he could easily have been impeached. Clinton should have been impeached for real violations instead of this crap that they tried to impeach him over. So Congress, as we look at the Republicans in the 90s, the 2000s, or actually the later 2000s, you know, after the Bush administration, that Congress really just started taking far more passive and going, well, we don't like what you're doing, but we're not going to impeach you, so don't worry. Because there were too many people that were running around going, you know, they're going to try to do impeach him because he's black.
Whatever.
My point is, you can actually find that. So we're out of time, Paul. I really appreciate your contributions. I appreciate you coming in this week. We'll be back next week, folks, regarding the new North Carolina debates. There's a lot more to cover, but it's one bite at a time, line upon line, precept upon precept. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.